So, Daddy, do you not like animals then? And he goes, no, I do like animals. And she goes, but you kill them. You can't say you like them and then kill them as well. And he goes, well, I don't kill them myself. Somebody else kills them and then I eat them. And she'll be like, well, what does that make you, Daddy? And he says, that makes me a hypocrite.
Welcome to the Anthrozoology Podcast, Part 15, which continues with Part 3 of our Anthrozoology Speak series. Today we continue our conversation with Emma McLean, founder of Hound Charming, and we discuss the interactions between anthrozoology and force-free training.
Hi, I'm Michelle Sidlowski. I'm an assistant professor at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida, and a member of the University of Exeter EASE group.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm doing my PhD with Exeter University and also a member of the EASE group.
Hiya, I'm Emma McLean. I'm the founder of Hound Charming. I also work as a horse trainer, force-free at Horse Charming, and I'm a qualified canine behaviourist.
Hello, my name's Sarah Oxley-Heaney and I'm a part-time PhD student at the University of Exeter and I'm also a member of the EASE group. Do you have any questions for us, Emma? Because actually, I think you're probably a natural anthrozoologist, even though you probably don't realise.
I do have a couple, actually. I mean, I was wondering how anthrozoology can kind of be used as a tool or a vehicle to change the way that animals are used by human animals for sport or social status or commercial gain. Like, what do you think needs to happen in that narrative to kind of alter that for animals?
I think a lot of that comes down to just the fact that it's an emergent field and that people are finally talking about these things. I mean, back to what you said in the very beginning about people's perceptions of horses and racing horses. I have this conversation every semester with my students in their intro class about horse racing, and they always respond, racing horses have it so good. They're so well treated. They're treated like kings. They're treated like, to which I always have to say, eh. And there is this public perception. And I think that educating the public in ways like this, you know, podcasting and more accessible platforms is the way to get those messages across, as opposed to relying on academic papers, which are only written for academics. I think that's step one.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, it's such a commonly held belief that they love to run, you know, they love to run. If they love to run, why is he hitting him every 3 seconds? You know, it's kind of like you would be running too if someone had a gun to your head, you know. run. You know, that's the situation the animal is in. And like, it sounds so simplistic, but sometimes if we can just get the person to put themselves in the animal's paws or hooves or whatever and go, this is an equivalent description, but now imagine you're at the center of it. And they sort of go, oh, I don't like that. I had this recently with a client, actually. She's a really lovely client, but she was kind of like, look, I'm taking his chew thing away and he's growling at me. Why is he doing that? And I'm like, I'm taking your purse away. Why are you trying to stop me? Do you know what I mean? And she's like, oh, yes, of course. But it's just, we don't necessarily go there in our minds.
Right. Well, and even my students who are trained in animal behavior and animal husbandry will still go in and reach to pick up a guinea pig from over the top of the guinea pig and just like, well, I don't know why the guinea pig's running away. Well, if some giant creature came into your bedroom and tried to grab you out of bed, how would you feel? And they're just, so even people who are pretty well experienced are still lacking that sense of oomph, you know, of understanding the environment and the perceptions of other species.
It's really struck by what you were saying about, the racehorses and this perception that they have the best life. And even amongst horse people, that persists. And I was immediately reminded to, back in the day where I'd have an immaculately groomed horse and I'd see somebody with the horse has straw in their tail and it's like, oh, you don't care about, you're a terrible horse person. And it's sort of looking back how I kind of just fell for that because that was the culture. But really the horse doesn't care. I mean, as long as you remove mud from anywhere that's going to rub them, they don't care if there's straw in their tail or if there's Yeah.
Mm, yeah. One
doesn't that sort of harken back to all of our discussions about street dogs and street cats and free ranging cats, that if you've lived on the street for 8 years, you know, we have this human perception that we must swoop them up and take them into homes because they'll be so much happier, rather than stopping and thinking, gee, maybe that free roaming cat would prefer to be a free roaming cat, you know? So yeah. I think it's these discussions that are really helpful in getting sort of people to reconsider their thought processes concerning other species.
Mm, that's a really interesting point. And I've heard you guys talk on the notion of feral before, and it was fascinating stuff for me, because obviously most of the people that I'm helping have got ex-street dogs. And the things that come up a lot and that really cause a lot of struggle are the things that once they're off leash, they just go, you know, because it's that innate kind of drive to be free roaming. And then we put them in a 2-bedroom apartment and take them for 2 20-minute leash walks a day. And then when we let them off, they're like, whoa, freedom. And, you know, there's no recall there and stuff. And I'm working with a lady at the moment, actually, who is integrating a street dog into her existing household with another ex-street dog. And what she's doing is just brilliant, and it is going so, so well, is she's giving him freedom to leave. Whenever he wants to leave, he just leaves. And what's happening is he's coming back more and more. Mm-hmm. And then said to me this morning, I hope that maybe one day he'll stay, because each day he's staying longer and longer. And she said, is it normally this easy? I said, no, it's not. It's just giving him the freedom to leave, and he knows that he can leave. You know, that's empowering, isn't it? Choice is something we don't give them so often.
But going back to what other zoology can do, I think it's exactly as Chris Michelle just said. It's like challenging people's perspectives, challenging speciesism, challenging culture, you know, and saying, yes, but just because it is done that way, why it doesn't mean it still needs to be done that way. Why are you thinking like that? What makes you? It's all the things you're already doing, making people reflect. And unfortunately, I think that when we do those things, when we try and ask people, why do you now act like this when you perhaps feel that you should be acting in a different way, because maybe that's why you've come to, for example, you as a client, it's challenging people and it makes them uncomfortable. So I think androzoology, just perhaps as your role, actually, because it's challenging people outside their comfort zone, it is, being an anthrozoologist should actually be something which is an uncomfortable space, a liminal space, Michelle, to actually make people think about, you know, why we as human animals, again, lumping us all together, act in specific ways, when maybe we should be questioning why we're doing that. And as always, that makes people uncomfortable. So I think that's how anthrozoology helps. We're a little spike in people's size, I think.
Yeah. And I think also it's back to that decommodifying other species, that taking away that human exceptionalism, that your dog or the dog that lives in your house does not need to serve a purpose in your household other than being a member of your family. That a rescue cow does not need to serve a purpose other than being intrinsically valuable for being a living thing, you know. And it's that that reassessment that non-humans are not just commodities. They're individuals, they're life forces, they're beings beyond what they can do for us.
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
So related to this idea of decommodification, and I wonder if that's why the force-free training in horses isn't so prominent, because when I think why people keep horses, it's predominantly for to ride them. And there's a lot of competition tied up, even if they're not competing in events for prizes, they're sort of wanting to be a better rider, or they're wanting to there's this whole competition thing. And I guess there's some element there with dogs, people that do competitions with dogs or dog trainers. So there's this idea of, even needing to train them, whereas cats I see more as you share a home with them, so they're like a family member. So it's more about, yeah, getting along, so there's not this need to, although the kind of it is a little bit with this the popularity of leash training cats and training cats, and that actually worries me, because not in principle, because I think some cats do enjoy it, but this idea that you can train cats and every cat is gonna want to be taken on a leash. So yeah, I can't actually remember if that started off as a question or not. But yeah, so this idea of, yeah, we want to dominate animals and we want to sort of use them to show off, I guess. It's competition.
Yeah, and we'll ascribe them with kind of negative labels to justify needing to dominate them. So, you know, with horses especially, or dogs, you know, we often hear the old dominant horse, dominant mare, lead mare, or alpha dog, you know, all this kind of stuff, all this sort of language that's become embroiled in sort of punitive training. And it's because it's born out of fear sometimes, I think. You know, we want to know that we can control the animal and make it do what we want. And, you know, there's so much social conditioning that goes on around horses and dogs. You know, they both are vehicles for our enjoyment in different ways. You know, horses carry us around and they're a status symbol, and, you know, like you say, take them to shows. And dogs, you know, are our biddable servant, they're man's best friend. So we don't want them to step out of line, and we don't want you to step out of line. I mean, you don't hear people kind of saying, oh, I've got a dominant rabbit, or I've got a dominant mouse, or a dominant guinea pig. It's like this language kind of revolves around these species that we want to kind of control, and, you know, starting to kind of strip that away, I think, is a really important part of the narrative, and kind of call people out on it and say, well, what do you mean by dominant? Well, he's doing this and he's doing that. Oh, okay, so he is in possession of a valuable resource he'd like to keep. And it's like back to that example. So is your wallet an item of value you'd like to keep? So are you dominant? You know, do you know what I mean? And kind of just stripping it back and kind of going, no, that's not what's happening here. This is a narrative that we're kind of spoon fed, you know, through our whole lives. If you've grown up with horses like you and I have done, it's all about that, isn't it? About control and leadership and all that business. And yeah, I mean, one of the other questions that I had was, I mean, I don't know if this is probably not, there's probably no such thing as too controversial for you lot, but something that I've thought about and kind of questioned my mentor on is this idea that if we go back to that initial discussion that we had about putting the animal's emotional, mental and physical well-being at the center of what we do, how can we be a force-free trainer who eats animals? And there are force-free trainers out there that eat animals, and that for me is a very kind of at odds kind of thing, like, because we accept that, you know, animals are sentient beings with their own rich emotional lives on the one hand, but on the other hand, chocolate, milk, cheese, bacon, do you know what I mean? And how do we kind of navigate that question?
I think a lot of us are still navigating that question, and we talk about it all the time, because I still drink dairy products. Well, not drink them, I still have cheese. And it is a struggle that I think we all realize that part of that acceptance is that we should not be doing so, but I do it anyway. It's that cognitive dissonance that is part of the struggle. We're sort of, I think, hardwired to take what we want out of the world almost. And we've been acting that way for so long that it's really hard to give up that convenience for another's well-being, whether it's a human species, because we also tend to stomp on other human species to take humans. I'm so used to saying other words. We tend to stomp on other humans to get what we want. You know, we make sure that nobody can touch my property. We don't feel like we need to share our wealth and income. We don't feel like we need to treat other humans as equals, and that sort of trickles down. So I think a lot of that is social change, you know, until we really can accept that every single human has intrinsic value. It's going to be hard for us to get to treating members of other species as having intrinsic value. And we don't have a good track record with treating other humans well either.
Yeah.
I don't think we really need to do it. Are you saying that we need to treat other humans well before we consider treating other animals well? I'm playing devil's advocate.
No, not at all. But what I'm saying is that we just have such a long cultural history of othering women, anyone who identifies as non-binary, other races. We have such a long history of doing this that it's sort of built into our society and our ethos, and we need to work on getting over it. And we're not going to make any progress probably with other species if we can't make progress with other humans. And so I think part of that is that recognition that not only do we want to help other species, we also have to flip it back and be reflexive and look at ourselves and say, we're also not doing very well with other humans.
But for me to answer that question, Emma, I think that it's a massive challenge. It's massive. I mean, we're all brought up, well, let's say in our society, we're all brought up with being meat eaters and animal products. You know, we're all brought up with using and utilizing animal products. And even if at some point you've gone, well, surely whatever they're going to do to animals, they'll be kind, because we didn't, you know, before social media, etc., we didn't really know exactly what was going on. And I remember being thrust a leaflet when I was 20 something about what they did to animals for meat production, and I gave up meat, but I was a vegetarian and I was still eating dairy products. And it wasn't until much later that I kind of like realized that actually that is a whole industry of cruelty in itself. But I think one of the problems is we make these things in our heads. It's very, very uncomfortable to have to suddenly upturn everything you've believed in and everything that you've been told, to realize that you've been lied to by society, and you kind of lied to yourself, because you've been thinking like, well, you know, I'm sure there'll be, you know, if we're going to eat milk, if we're going to drink milk, they'll be nice to the cows, and the cows will go in the field afterwards, and there's probably some massive like retirement home for cows or something like that. You know, you kind of like make these things up. When you actually eventually find the truth, it's quite shocking.
Yeah,
we either have, we form a barrier which we don't want to pass through, and we manage to keep that up, or we do eventually go, we kind of like go into this existential crisis of like, oh my God, what's happening? How many animals are we actually doing this to? And realize that you live on a planet of cruelty and harm and devastation to many beings that live on the planet. And I then think you have to get through that, because that's quite a scary thought. And then you go, right, what can I do about it? Do I want to do anything about it? And am I going to do anything about it? And then once you've decided that, you have to find out what you can do about it, because there's so much in products that you don't realize are not vegan, or let's not use the word vegan, that you do not realize are not using animal products in that food product that you eventually have to do a lot of research. So you can't, it took me a year. I said, right, I've given myself a year to stop eating animal products. So I used to be the irritating person again, anthrozoologist, irritating person, challenging people, but the irritating person who'd be in the supermarket reading the back of labels, googling what that E number was, etc., etc. And you know, I think so it's a whole process, because we're so ingrained with this eating or using animal products to benefit ourselves, or to even to sustain ourselves, because many people have been told that you have to use animal products to sustain yourself, to sustain your health. It's really difficult to extract yourself from that. So I don't know whether the answer is that you say to people, look, you know that you've got to change because of your health, because of the climate, because of the animals, and you're saying that you love animals and you're doing this, etc. Or to actually be kind of very gentle and persuasive, etc. And I think that comes down to one's own personality. Like, you're probably the very persuasive, nice, gentle, you know, convincing type, whereas I'm more the I'm not that kind of person. I try to be, but it's not natural. It's not my natural state, unfortunately. So I think that whole question is really interesting, and it's a massive challenge. And I don't think there's one answer, but it's kind of, if we think it's important enough to other species and to ourselves, we have to challenge that. We have to challenge people. But the way that we do that, we have to navigate that ourselves.
And And I totally agree with what you said earlier about it's about the individual taking ownership and going, okay, what can I do? And I know you know her, my friend Vicky Spitt. I mean, she's quite outspoken regarding her veganism and stuff. And, you know, she can come up against, you know, well, you're buying processed, you know, because she will openly say that she eats, you know, let's say a vegan burger, which is processed, and, you know, your carbon footprint for that burger, and, you know, the plastic and all of that business. And she just kind of comes back at him and go, well, shall I not bother then? Shall I just eat all the animals instead then? You know, it's about what I can do. You know, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's not expect everybody to be perfect, but let's try and kind of encourage change in individuals, I think, for sure. And my little girl is growing up not eating animal products for the most part, and her dad still does, and that is a really interesting thing to kind of watch unfold. And, you know, fair play to him really, because he doesn't try and mislead her or minimize or anything like that. And they've had some brilliant conversations about it where she'll go, so daddy, do you not like animals then? And he goes, no, I do like animals. And she goes, but you kill them. You can't say you like them and then kill them as well. And he goes, well, I don't kill them myself. Somebody else kills them and then I eat them. And she'll be like, well, what does that make you, daddy? And he says, that makes me a hypocrite. It makes me a hypocrite. And I was like, you're so proud of you at that moment, that little exchange. I was just like, that is it. Brilliant. But yeah, they're the next generation, I suppose, aren't they? And they'll carry the mantle, and sort of maybe in another 30 years, the conversation will be much more developed than it is now, hopefully.
Well, I certainly hope so, because it's probably 27 years ago since I picked up that leaflet, and I don't see a great shift in I mean, there are more people who are eating plant-based foods, people who are trying to avoid harm to animals, etc. But in fact, apparently the amount of meat that the world is eating has gone up, and it's still going up, and it's going up and up and up. And we are just in such a dreadful position in terms of, if you just think about the forcing of animals into those positions, never mind climate and health and all that kind of stuff.
I think part of that goes to our general cognitive overload of this time in our evolution, in that, I mean, I see this with my intro classes every semester when we start talking about our use of animals and commodity, and we try to list all of the ways that we use animals, and then we get into food animals, and there's this moment where you see the perspectives kind of switch, and then there's this downhill spiral into a very dark place, which is, oh my gosh, there's nothing I can do. And even if I wanted to, I can't change the world. I can't. And we do it in our climate change conversations in my ecology classes as well. It gets very dark, and it gets to the point where a lot of people have to turn off to protect themselves. And one of the ways that we deal with that is, first off, by warning them, this, you're going to start thinking about this. And once you start thinking about it, you have to deal with the sadness that accompanies that. And you have to learn to protect yourself and look for the positive. And then the flip side of that is doing what Emma was saying. We give them one small thing to do. Okay. So your family eats a lot of meat. Great. What if one day a week you don't eat meat? And they're like, I can do that. You know, what if one day a week you bring your recyclable or your reusable water bottle to class instead of bringing a plastic bottle? Oh, I can do that. And once you start empowering these tiny little behaviors, I think that they start to find new little behaviors that they can do. And then eventually we'll start seeing a change. But I agree. I mean, look at how long we've known about the problems with our environment and the problems with climate change and the problems with our treatment of other human beings. And we still sadly are doing the exact same things over and over.
Yeah, it's like change is the problem. Knowing is one thing. And I was thinking, so I smoked for 15 years. I knew it was bad for me. I even sort of tried to give up, or knew I should give up, and But I did eventually, but it was hard. And I think that's the key thing. I mean, you know something's harmful to yourself, to others, the planet, and
yeah, definitely
the enact change that you can do or you feel you can do.
Mm-hmm. So in essence, I think there's like, I was just looking at Foxy this morning and I was thinking about all of the other street cats that who do not have good lives on the street, you know. And I was thinking, you know what, maybe this living being on this planet is just about connecting with other living beings and actually bringing some happiness. So I think that's the first thing, trying to find a bit of meaning to life. And the second thing is, I think if we truly want change, then we have to put ourselves out there as being the people who challenge people, which doesn't make us popular. But I would rather die thinking I've tried to do something and been unpopular than be the person who's like, you know, who's, yeah, I had lots of people that I got on with, but I didn't actually try to, even if I don't make any change, I didn't even try.
But see, for me, the people who come to me who are like militant about anything, who come to me and say, you must do this, or this is the right way, I shut down. And so I very much go the opposite way, where I would rather start a conversation, because I think through that conversation, maybe you'll begin to change, as opposed to if I yell at you. Like if I told my 19-year-old students, you must not eat meat. Your teacher is telling you, look, I'm old, I'm telling you, don't eat meat. What are they going to do? They're going to totally shut down, right? So just by opening that conversation and telling them, I'm not going to tell you what to do. Let's look at this and let's reflect a little bit. I think that's key.
So you're saying the next podcast should be about cheese?
I'm trying so hard. I come from a long line of dairy farmers, people. It's in my genetic code, and breaking that genetic code is hard, but I'm trying. And also the other thing related to that is that you don't know this, Emma, but I recently moved to the American South, which is quite a new experience. And I'm from Colorado, where, you know, I was vegan for a long time and had no problem because you could just go get plant-based food everywhere, you know, where in the South, plant-based food means French fries. There are no, you know, quick pickup places. There are no real salad places. There are very few options. It's much more difficult. And so I can see why, depending on where you live, it's much more difficult. So if I was someone who was raised in the American South, I can see how it would be almost impossible to stop eating meat. So yeah, I think that's a lot of it too. So having these conversations, having these questioning things, I think is the first step.
And I've noticed there are changes, and maybe you've noticed them too, Sarah, in the UK, not sort of living there, but so I've had long periods where I haven't lived here, and I've come back. And back when I was a teenager, going to a restaurant and there would be the token vegetarian dish, there'd be like one option, and now there's sort of several. It's more typical, there's several vegetarian options, maybe even two vegan options. And I go into the supermarket and there's this whole sections of plant-based products. And I've really noticed that.
Yeah, 100%. There's so much more. There's so many more options. The UK, when I last went there, which was before COVID, was fantastic. Now, I do believe, though, and it was before Brexit as well, possibly, or the final transition date, that there was an EU law out that said every restaurant had to offer at least one vegan, one vegetarian option. And that's definitely the case in Portugal. So maybe the UK was under that kind of rule.
Sadly, do they consider those vegetarian options a salad?
No, they're really good. Really?
Okay, good. Because here that's, you know, if they say they offer a vegetarian option, what it means is you can have a green garden salad.
It was like that in Kentucky, but then they'd want to put bacon bits on it. Yes. Like, they'd offer me a salad and then they'd put bacon bits on it.
Caesar dressing. It's like Caesar dressing.
Just want to say, Emma, thank you very much for joining us today. That was a fantastic discussion. And hopefully you can join us again at some point and we can talk about interrelated things between your forestry training and anthrozoology discussions. That'd be fantastic.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks for having me.